Welcome to All in a Day's Sex Work. I'm your host, Blair Hopkins. So, some of you may remember that this show used to be weekly, and then around this time last year, I just kind of dropped off the map and would only release every once in a while. What happened? When I started this show in January of 2020, it was a hobby project meant to continue creating content in the vein of my book of the same name. At the time, I was working only as a freelancer, and of course, as we would all like to not have to remember, 2020 went insane. In lockdown, it was actually really easy and frankly lovely to adhere to maintaining a rigorous weekly production schedule, but in January 2021, I took on a full-time role with the sponsor of this show, Swap Behind Bars, and my duties as then-deputy director, now acting executive director, in this rapidly expanding organization began to overtake my availability for the demands of regular production. All that said, I have really missed giving this show regular attention, and I want to do so again. And even when I wasn't in regular production, I was still conducting interviews. All the conversations that I had in this last year that have yet to see the light of day fully deserve to. So, in the spirit of engaging the intention I have to resume bringing you this show as often as possible, I'd like to start releasing that backlog of conversations. I intend to release on a bi-weekly basis, interspersing the backlogged episodes with new content, and then attempt to maintain that schedule with the goal of getting back up to weekly new releases soon. As always, if you're a sex worker, partner, patron, or other adult industry adjacent person, I still want to hear from you. Email me at info@adswproject.org. The first of these archived interviews is with author C.E. Hoffman. Hoffman and I spoke about her then newly released book, Sluts and Whores. By its own accord, Sluts and Whores explores the humanity of sex workers, whores, and people who are proudly sexual, sluts. Each story questions stereotypes that are long out of date, merging horror with heartache and magic with the mundane. The book is a semi-autobiographical collection of essays in which Hoffman leads the reader through intensive world and character building, aimed at fleshing out a holistic understanding of the young protagonist, a sex worker in an imaginary city based loosely on Toronto, as she grows into herself personally, professionally, and sexually. It's a beautiful book that I immensely enjoyed getting lost in, both when I read it immediately prior to our interview in 2021, and again before I re-edited our conversation recently for air. Hoffman is also about to release a new chapbook via Alien Buddha Press titled Blood, Booze, and Other Things in Nature. More information about both volumes is available at cehoffman.net. So, without further ado, here is my conversation with the wonderful C.E. Hoffman.
Hey.
Hey, Blair.
How's it going?
Good. Just a sec. I can only hear you in one ear, which isn't a huge deal, but can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Okay, good. That's fine. It'll just be a left ear session for me. That's no problem.
Oh, the tribulations, the tribulations.
As far as it goes, I'm not too concerned, especially we're just stepping out of Mercury retrograde. So one of my headphones being busted, that's pretty minor. I'm not complaining.
Right. I am just getting used to this new setup and I'm using like computer audio only. And so far it seems to be okay. I actually am really relieved by when I started the show, I was very wound tight about the audio quality. And then when the pandemic happened and like, you know, you had like Ira Glass posting photos of him recording the intro to the show in his closet, I was like, you know what? We're good. We're good.
I actually love that idea. One of the positive sides of pandemic that it really brought us all back to DIY. There's that punk aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I suppose so. Yeah. It's funny because there was a lot of dialogue early on about the pandemic being like the great equalizer, and that got quite a bit of backlash going on the internet. But in a way it's like, well, you can't really see what the deficiencies are in society very clearly until you have some kind of level playing field, right? Some kind of levelizer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. At least we could definitely say there was some type of localized equalization. Obviously, globally, things have been really different for various groups in various places. But I totally agree that, especially, I mean, for me, the Western world is my experience. So that's what I can talk from. It's been that enforced isolation, you know, talking about retrogrades, it's almost like all of us were collectively thrust into multiple year-long spiritual retrograde. All of us were suddenly, in some cases, really forced to sit still. And being an introvert, it wasn't too challenging for me, but my sympathy and compassion definitely especially goes out to extroverts. I know so many of my extroverted friends have been honestly dancing with madness in this realm of isolation.
Yeah, a lot of people just climbing the walls. Where were you for the, or where are you rather?
Oh, well, where it has changed where I've been across the pandemic. I remember distinctly living in Toronto, the first lockdown, because I had my little flip phone. So those governmental alerts don't show up properly on my flip phone. I just get this weird blaring sound, which I'm sure is true of more advanced phones. Okay. And then the, like, I would say the first two lines of the warning message are just repeated ad infinitum on this long scrolling message. So it said something to the effect of, all, you know, people in Ontario, stay inside.
Over and over again.
Yeah, like ad infinitum, ad nauseum, right? And it was just this really funny moment for me. You know, again, all of our coping mechanisms were tested. And for me, I just kind of laughed in that space of huge open surrealism, because that's really what unexpected events are, right? Novelty is a threat, but it's also an opportunity, because it's widening your spheres of perception and existence. And I actually like that space. I think artists play in that space as a rule. And I have seen that. I've seen so many fantastically creative humans get all the more fantastically creative in this space. And then, so yeah, that was the majority of COVID for me, was my little basement suite with my cat in Toronto. But then mid-pandemic, I moved back here to Edmonton with my parents, with the cat lovingly in tow, and here I yet remain.
I'm curious about the creative stretching out. I didn't have the, I kept working throughout the pandemic, and I was working for a federal agency for a lot of it, as well as for SWAP. So I was doing end of life care for my grandmother. So I actually had less time than I normally would to creatively indulge, but I'm wondering if it was different for you because you're already naturally an introvert. Like, how did this shift change your process, or did it at all?
Yeah, that's such a good question and so good to note. I think it is also true of us introverts. I don't know how you identify, but I honestly think introverts are a bit selfish. And I'm not saying that disparagingly. It's just that our internal reality is so immense and intense. There's such breadth and depth within the confines of our hearts and skulls that it's difficult for us to remember other people, and that other people are, like you so rightly compared, are dealing with things differently and have different circumstances that'll either be enhancing or compressing their experience. And I have to say, yeah, there really wasn't a change, which again does sound kind of like you're already isolated, which I would agree introverts for the most part are. I've often wondered if introversion is an incongruence with inner self and outer reality. And one of the ways that you then cope with that and manage that is by spending time alone to recharge from these, you know, perceived incongruences. And for me, when I look back at previous creative projects, like the novel I first wrote when I was 11, I was writing that when I was waiting for school to start. I was going to the same school that my dad was teaching at. So we would arrive at the school, I don't know how long before the bell went, but long enough that I was able to start sitting at a computer in his desk, at his desks, and start writing. And then it was the same after school. There would be some time he'd be grading papers and I'd be at the computer. And when I think of that time as it stretched out before me, and then the story started to carry along within those timeframes, it feels the same when I look at a space like the pandemic And obviously, I know my immense privilege is there that I haven't been on the front lines. You know, I haven't been working in any capacity. I have been very safe in a way for which I'm very grateful and that I wish were available to others. I am aware of that, but I do see that it is a continuation of those previous themes in my life of just being alone with your art and feeling sometimes more at home there than you do with other people. And then of course the hope, especially with now finally having a book out, is using that self-expression as a means of connecting with others. Because connection, of course, is still something I really love and crave. I mean, who doesn't, you know?
It sounds like writing is kind of your first language.
Oh, that's a beautiful idea. I'm kind of holistic when I approach art. There's this actually great line in Jack Wang's novella, We Two Alone. The main character is a struggling actor. And within his narration, he expresses this idea that there's a mania only shared by actors. And I was very blessed to actually be able to talk with Jack Wang recently. And I expressed to him how much I love that line and only amended that such mania ravages all artists, including us writers. I really feel that there's a certain type that's drawn to artistry. And artistry needn't be, you know, corralled by our preconceptions of what art is. I think you can be an artist as a doctor, you know, as a teacher. I think anything which imbues deep, great meaning on any participant is ultimately artistic.
Do you think that there are those who, for whom writing or other pursuits that would be considered artistic in most people's hands are, like, for some people, it's actually just arbitrary? Have you ever explored? Like, have you ever, like, I've done a lot of, for example, I've been a freelance photographer for a lot of years, what, 14 years now. And I think about the way that I relate to that artistry when I am doing something that is, that my heart is in or that is fulfilling to me versus when I'm doing like family portraits because I really needed the money, or I'm doing like commercial product photography. And it occurs to me that for some people, maybe because they're doing copywriting or it just happens to be a skill that they have, there's like a mechanical or arbitrary element to it.
Oh, absolutely. You're so right that it's not only the force, but it's the application of said force within certain contexts. And I think that's the fun of art too. I mean, I just finished On Writing by Stephen King. The Elements of Style by Strunk and White has been my Bible for a long time, but this is my first foray into On Writing. And it's true that you do have to, I think, to a degree, fall in love with the mechanics. I think those aspects that are rudimentary and our work do need to become as beloved as that, you know, space of beautiful madness. You know, it's almost like those are the masculine and feminine elements to creation. And it's so true. I guess I'm lucky in that I've never yet, knock on wood, had to sacrifice my idealistic intentions for a paycheck regarding my art or my writing. I've had times where I was writing for magazines where maybe there were creative clashes with editors and things like that. So in some sense there, your integrity feels a bit compromised. But overall, I've always written for my muse and hopefully in all eventuality for the universe in some small, beautiful way.
Well, and those things are intertwined too. Those compromises can be intertwined because, you know, throughout the process of gaining experiences that give you fodder, those experiences inherently might be compromising to what you would consider to be like your art or your true path. But what you do then is kind of alchemy, you know, turning those experiences, whether they're good, bad, or indifferent, into the art that you want to put out into the world.
Oh, I love that. Exactly. Shit into gold. And I think that from the greatest shits come the greatest golds. I don't want to get fatalistic with that, obviously I'm more into Taoism than Buddhism, let's put it that way. But I do struggle with that idea, you know, is a certain amount of shit inevitable if you wish to alchemize gold? And I still don't know. When I look back at my own life, all I really see from pain is lessons. Were those lessons necessary? Yes. Was it necessary to be taught those lessons via those means? I don't think that's an answer I will have. If I ever get that answer, I think I'll be grateful for it. But I think that's really what matters. You know, it's not so much toying with those deterministic ideas. It's more just recognizing whatever you're given can become gold, should you apply the right force to it.
I think that collectively and individually, we have an impulse to superimpose a narrative onto, or like a narrative arc onto our experiences in a way that when done personally can be really empowering, where it's like, I went through this thing and it led me here. On a broader societal level, sometimes I think it can be really damaging because it turns people's personal struggles into something that is meant to just further a narrative. But it's a difficult distinction, because it's like, if I had made different choices, would I have had to have learned the same lessons, and would it have just manifested differently? Versus, is there some, you know, like, is there some kind of greater destiny that I'm fulfilling? Versus, is this all just kind of like a big choose your own adventure novel?
Oh, I love that. And I love that you brought it back to choice. I mean, obviously, when we're children, there's no choice there. And of course, that's where the majority of our traumas yet reside for us to dig into. But beyond that, there is always choice. And I guess I'm really lucky, because you're so right about that narrative force of the ego. That's what the ego is. The ego is a storyteller, and the ego loves to make itself the, you know, the victim or the hero as a rule, sometimes the villain, especially if you're kind of masochistic. There's definitely that there. And I guess I'm really lucky that I have the avenue of written word, because there is so much of myself, and not to mention just people I've heard of, people I've met and loved, in my writing. I always say it's not autobiographical, but I can't necessarily call it pure fiction either. And I think any honest writer would have to agree to a degree. But it's so different once you alchemize those narrations onto paper. It no longer belongs to you. It's no longer the ego's property. Suddenly it belongs to art, which I think is kind of the shelf unit of the collective consciousness. And there's always that hope that if you put your personal pieces out there, someone else can do that. And it's like you're building another shelf for other people. You put your little piece there, and then they can leave their stuff on that shelf with yours. And that's how we heal, hopefully. I mean, it's a bit of a clumsy analogy, but I think the intention behind it is pretty beautiful. That idea that when you're healing yourself, you will invariably heal others, especially if you're lucky enough to have your healing somehow transmuted to them. And I think writing is an excellent medium for that. Stephen King compares it to telepathy. I disagree. Telepathy is a two-way street. Writing is a one-way street. It's a transmission. But one does hope that one's transmissions light up sparks in your reader's heart, that it's an impactful and effective mirror, not only just for showing them their flaws, but showing them the beauty within and beyond those flaws. That's always a theme I try to work in through with my writing. I find I respect transgressive fiction. I owe so much to it. Yet sometimes I feel they don't go far enough or deep enough into those ugly areas of the human condition. They show you that ugliness and do little else to resolve it. Whereas I really like that idea of finding the stars in the gutter, to toy with Oscar Wilde a bit there, to remind people that this fucked upness in no way negates the possibility of a happy, full life.
that autobiographical versus kind of speculative, I don't want to say conflict, but I guess it is kind of a conflict that a lot of writers wrestle with. There's a lot of kind of magical realism in your writing in particular, but obviously there is some personal experience that serves as a rudder.
That's a great way to describe it. I always joke to people that I basically, as a rule, take my life and throw in some demons. That's kind of what I love about fantasy, to be honest. I've been thinking about this a lot, that fantastic scenarios are catalysts to character development. In a way, I think I would probably love to make the hypothesis that most fantasy and sci-fi writers are introverts. And what we're doing is we're like projecting an externalization of our internal universe, which is arguably mostly an emotional atmosphere. You know, the intense highs and lows that I experience in my body and mind are transmuted into characters, into monsters, into demons, into angels, into pixies, and they come alive in that place once I personify them, which is, it's very cool. I mean, really, what is that? I mean, obviously that's working with archetypes, just not always from the most conscious space. I'm trying to be more conscious with working with archetypes. I have one novel in need of editing right now that features Kali as a character, like the actual embodiment of that Hindu goddess. So obviously I was very consciously approaching that entity, but I think no matter how conscious we try to be, like the strongest demons are just gonna slip in unawares without our knowledge. And then it's up to our readers to catch them.
Right, and like you say, once it's been put on the page and put out there, it doesn't belong to you anymore anyway. So your intentions aren't really that important anymore to anyone but yourself.
Exactly. And I do think the integrity of authorship is vital. And I want to take responsibility for my writing. You know, I've often hired sensitivity readers and things like that. It's very important to be aware of how powerful words are. I think words are magic. You know, I don't think you need to identify with, you know, an idea of a God figure or anything to feel that. But I do feel that they're a real gift from God. You know, they literally, I mean, they don't, yeah, maybe they don't literally shape our reality the way magic in books do necessarily, but they shape something even more important, which is our inner world.
Can you explain what sensitivity readers are and what that process is like?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, obviously this collection is, it can safely fly under the flag of an own voices piece regarding mental health, mental illness, suicide, and sex work experiences, as well as sexual trauma, because those are my experiences that I've lovingly and somewhat cautiously poured into this book. But there is a diverse cast of characters, sexualities, ethnicities, and I think almost especially for certain groups of people where there's been a lack of dignity in their representation by authors or creators who don't share their backgrounds. I think it is very helpful and important for, especially I think, white authors to respectfully reach out and ask someone, ideally someone you know who's also a creative, if they can impart their thoughts. And obviously it can be a scary thing, but for me, the fear really doesn't matter, because it's like, you know, if there's something problematic here, I want to know about it before it goes on to the shelf of the collective consciousness and potentially falls and hits someone on the head and hurts them. You know, I don't want that. And it's never going to be perfect because everyone's opinions are different. But that's basically what you do. You reach out and you say, hey, you know, this story, you know, features a character, you know, could you please share your thoughts? And if you think this is valid representation, you know, of a First Nations woman or whatever it may be, you know, and I think the most important step there, because I think sometimes people almost just want to cover their tracks, which I get, you know, we all want to cover our ass, but the important part has yet to arrive. The important part is to listen when they come back to you, especially if they say, hey, you know, this was a problem. And
I would argue that the most important part is paying them.
Oh, that is such a great point. Absolutely pay them. I would have gotten to that. But yes, it is such a good one to feature strongly there and ask them their rate, right? I think that's an important one too. Ask like what for you would be okay pay here for this emotional work, because that's largely what that is, right? But it's worth it. It's humbling. It's a great way to establish relationships also. And it's a great way to just learn and strengthen as a writer. Again, I think the most important thing about being a writer is being honest, and stereotyping isn't honest. Stereotyping is at its best ignorant.
It's also important to have that kind of respect for your ancillary characters, right? Just as a writer, I think in trying to overcome being ego-driven in one's writing, especially when that writing is kind of semi-autobiographical, like you're not terribly likely to have, you know, a character whose experience or ethnicity or whatever is completely divergent from your own as a protagonist. That would be maybe even a little inappropriate. It's at best difficult, but you want to give all of your supporting and ancillary characters in any narrative the respect and the like full-throatedness and full investigation that they deserve as characters as well.
Exactly. It's really just a matter of making your characters real and making your universe real. I mean, the big city, which is the city I mostly write in, it is a fictional kind of alternate universe city, alternate history city, actually, one should say. And I was inspired largely by living in Edmonton, especially the White Ave scene, and living in Toronto. And, you know, so when I was writing a more diverse cast of characters, it was just being honest and realistic about who I saw, who I was friends with. You know, I think it's just one of the most honest and healthy things to, yeah, be conscious that all of your characters are you, and that some of the best characters you can make are your friends. I mean, obviously within reason, you know, and without causing discomfort for any people, but all you need to make literary magic is to take a really long, hard look at your environment, and it is there. I think one of the keys to being a good writer is to be observant and not be scared of what you'll see. You know, I think one of the reasons we all tend to avoid that, apart from just the, you know, physical issue of sensory overload, is because reality can be very uncomfortable, especially when you're actually letting yourself see other people and feel them, you know, because that's where character comes from, is a vibe of someone. I mean, oh my gosh, even when I get to a more secure place financially, I hope I will always ride the bus. Because if you want to write something honest and beautiful and ugly and real and raw, the bus is your greatest resource. Like, there are some amazing people on there and some really troubled people, you know, people you wouldn't otherwise see. And I love that about public transit, that it kind of forces you to remember what you might want to forget.
It seems to me that you have kind of a complicated relationship to like the city. Like, that's one of the recurring themes that I sensed, is you use the phrase escaping the city in a lot of different contexts, or we can't escape a city, no one escapes the city. Can you elaborate on that and what that means to you?
Yeah, I love that. I mean, of course, in the context of the big city, it's kind of a convoluted backstory I'm still fleshing out in my world building, but essentially some tensions came to a climax that created a supernatural force around the city. So nobody can ever get out again. People can go in, but they can't go out. One amazing booktuber, Carbon Bonded Books, compared it to the Hotel California, that song, which I think is just amazing. I'll definitely need to reference that at some point. And I actually love you calling that to my attention, because I think that was something unconscious I was working through. Growing up in Edmonton was a low point of resonance for me. I never felt at home here. And as soon as my ego was strong enough to will it, I wanted only to escape. And there was often that feeling of dead end roads, you know, never ending alleys, never ending skies, flat prairies. And that's not to say there's no beauty here. There is a lot of beauty, and there's a lot of beautiful people who I respect and adore. But
you wanted more.
Yeah, and just something different. I think it's really valuable for an artist to be born somewhere that doesn't feel like home. I think having that emotional dissonance between you and your space, just like introversion, is really useful to alchemize into your art. And clearly that's what I did. Because of course there are some stories of people escaping the big city, but it's definitely not easy. And usually then the only other environments I write in are way more supernatural. Like you're looking at stories which are set in limbo. That's another realm I really write a lot in. And I'm looking forward to releasing more stuff that features that more. And then the one novel that I'm getting close to pitching to agents, Observing Love's Decay, is set in a, it just like the big city is kind of a satire of an urban environment. I call this place Little Town, which is just a few hours outside of the big city, where there are these two troubled teenagers who find magic in unexpected places, like many of the characters in Sluts and Whores. So, and Little Town is, it's a lot like Edmonton too. It just has a lot more of that dead end feeling. You know, the people joke, people call Edmonton Deadmonton. There is a certain woodedness that pervades here. And but again, how useful is that? It fueled two different cities in my books. I mean, I'm super grateful for that.
Yeah. And, you know, anybody who is not from Canada, specifically Americans, think of places like Edmonton. There's so much kind of mystique imbued upon Canadian cities. Like, we don't understand them and the way that they work. There's kind of like an M. Night Shyamalan like element too. When you think about a place like Edmonton, you're like, what's going on there? And it's funny because that happens within small cities as well. I actually projected all of my city, my complicated relationships with cities onto your city as being New York, because I spent 10 years there and had, you know, it was like my major developing years. It was like 22 to 30. And I remember reading, listening to the story, This Happened, and thinking when the friend explodes in the diner, I was like, I'm sure I've seen this happen. I'm 100% sure I've seen this happen in real life. It was a very, very solid archetype.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. I was anxious about that story because, of course, it's really just a foray into, you know, for lack of a better term, toxic masculinity. And I just wasn't sure if it would come off great, but I'm glad that even for you, especially living in such metropolis as New York, it, you know, there was a reckoning there for you going back, you know, there was a reminiscence. So that shows that it was still real.
Even in the end, when he's like calmed down and he's like, do you think I left enough of Pip? I was like, oh my God, that's perfect. That's what happened. I've probably dated that guy.
Okay, that's so great to hear. Because of course, any of the ones that are cheekily called This Happened are based on experiences of my own and usually, you know, extrapolated therefrom, essentially. But, and yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned Toronto, because of course, sorry, that you mentioned New York. Funny Freudian slip, given the point I'm about to make. My joke about Toronto is that it's Canadian New York, i.e. New York, but shittier. So hearing that for you, the big city could be likened to New York really fills me with satisfaction, because that is another intention. I love New York, but I've only visited, you know, enough times that I can count on one hand. And I'd love that to be more, but I can't lay claim to it as someone like you could.
I think it just goes to show that the inner workings of pretty much any city are the same, probably with the exception of the city that I currently live in. So I currently live in New Orleans. And it actually is a pretty, I mean, maybe this is just, I want to think this, but there's a lot of people who agree with me, but it's a pretty unique place and its workings are a little different from any other city I've spent time in. I've only visited Toronto, and I actually kind of have that same thought about it, that it is kind of like New York, but a little shittier. Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't know. I did it.
I know, it's kind of funny because I think that, you know, it's actually really exciting for me when I'm able to, you know, to talk to Americans who have read my book, because I again, I cheekily place the big city in North America. My characters aren't Canadian or American. I call them North Americans. I say that the big city is somewhere between New York and Montreal. Like, I'm being very cheeky about it because, I mean, I respect Canadian authors. I mean, Jack Wang, great example there. He's an exceptional Canadian author, you know, and there are a lot of them, but I've never really identified myself as a Canadian author writing about Canada. Lots of Canadian writers really write about Canada and they own that niche, which I think is great, but that's never really been for me. I've learned so much from British and American authors that for me, that's who I think I'm ultimately writing for. And maybe that's not fair, you know, to cast a Canadian audience aside. Because again, like Canadians, no matter how many may protest this, obviously there are some differences to our governmental systems to which I'm not privy because I'm not a political type person. But like the biggest cultural differences I can think of is, you know, the presence of guns is less up here. So again, America, but stabbings instead of shootings. I mean, that's so morbid, but I think it's pretty accurate, you know, and I think that when you look at Western culture, that's really what you're seeing is a North American culture. You know, we really, to me, are the same. And I know lots of Canadians wouldn't agree with that. And I think some Americans might think that that's a bit naive of a Canadian to presume, but I don't know. For me, it's like Scots versus Irish people. And again, that's a comparison that I'm sure would make some of them inimical, but I don't care. I think it's accurate. You know, you guys have got tartans and lilting accents and you're into your lagers. Like, what's the difference, you know?
I mean, I'm originally from the Pacific Northwest, so we're basically Canada. We're basically Canada. We have that same thing going on. There's actually my favorite Canadian author, the late, great David Rakoff, has a really great bit that he wrote about, or that he talked about, where he said, you know, he lived in New York for the last years of his life, the last like 20 years of his life. And he said that even being in America for so long, said he has like a radar for other Canadians. And he gave the example of Shania Twain. He was like, I don't know who she is. I don't know what she does. What I know is that she's Canadian. That's it. And I don't know how I know that. I don't even know how I know that.
It just happens. It's just this collective force. Oh no, I totally get that. And I think that like when you look at Canadian writers too, like Douglas Coupland, you know, I think he spent a lot of time in the States too. And, you know, his infamous Generation X is, to my recollection, set in the States. But of course, there's a character who's Canadian. And it's like, I like that. I like that Canadians have that ability to kind of make fun of ourselves. But of course, at the same time, I don't know, now that we're discussing nationality, there's also a lot of shame on Canada right now, you know, with these recent discoveries at residential schools, former residential schools. So, and maybe there's a bit of guilt in there too, for me, you know, even when I talk about how I never felt at home in the prairies, sometimes I wonder if there's been some kind of generational nostalgia there for me where it's like, well, you know, even if you've had, you know, if you have settler history here and everything, it's still not quite your home. And obviously I don't want to get into a debate about that. I think there's lots of people with settler history who do really deeply identify with this land. And I don't think that's necessarily wrong as long as you're paying proper respect to the people who were here, you know, and to the horrible things that happened since. But maybe there is something there for me too. You know, I grew up seeing a lot of Canadian pride. And the more I learned about the settling of Canada, the less prideful I felt about it, you know?
We're doing a lot of reckoning, I think, in Western culture right now. And that's happening at the same time as tremendous progress is taking place in a lot of different fronts. That's another recurring theme that I see throughout this book, is that you have kind of a lot of reticence about modernity and especially about technology.
Yes, I have a very funny relationship with technology. And of course, my caveat is I am indebted to it entirely. Without it, we wouldn't be having this beautiful exchange on the full moon. I am also concerned with its rapid expansion and the almost immediate codependence that I note in lots of users of it. Yeah, so actually, if you don't mind, I'll attempt to sing this, but that's a lot of what the backstory of The Big City is about, actually, where it's a very technologically advanced city. And this little seed group starts they're called the anti-techers. And I'm kind of playing with my own philosophy. You know, I had a flip phone. Currently, I don't have any phone. I'm begrudgingly using my mom's touch phone on occasion when necessary. So I'm kind of just recognizing how well-intentioned philosophies can be taken into extremity and tyranny. So the anti-techers obviously start out with very good intentions, you know, about unplugging and getting back to nature, but they start to get really militant. And then, of course, there's a counter movement that arises that's like, you know, my phone from like cold, dead hands, and it gets very partisanal. And it actually turns into like a full blown civil war riot kind of thing. And basically, my idea with that backstory is that like The Big City has always been like an epicenter of supernatural energy, you know, kind of alluding to the hell mouths in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And the demons have had plans for it for a long time to basically make it like an evil, nasty portal. And they use all of this momentum to create that blockage that then is going to block everyone in here. And their ideas, of course, are very nefarious from that point. But I mean, this plot that I'm discussing is honestly the plot of like my entire book universe, you know, so different segments of this are to be found in various different books. Observing Loves Decay obviously features little of it because Iris and Jackson, the main characters, are in a different place entirely. But of course, they're adjacent to these things that are going on. And at least I've mapped it to the point where I know that the year Observing Loves Decay takes place is the same year that riot in The Big City happens that then blocks off the city limits to its residents. So I'm getting there, but it's a lot to unpack. And again, I think that's because there's a lot internally for me to unpack. There's a lot for me to unpack about technology. And I just love really, I don't know, kind of blowing a raspberry in my own face with that idea of the anti-techers. Because of course, they get what they wanted. You know, they smash up all the technology, the power is out. And well, guess what? They got what they wanted to this ridiculous extreme. And now they're all in hell. They don't have anything, you know, they can't boil water, you know, like it's a total wasteland now. And I make all these cheeky jokes about like solar discs and generators that people have managed to scrap together because they suddenly realized, oh, okay, like maybe not all technology is bad. And I think it's a reminder to myself, you know, to by all means have your values, have your considerations and concerns, but you know, try to be objective, try to be balanced, you know, try not to swing to one end of the pendulum just to compensate, because that's usually what we do, you know, when we're being countercultural, that's usually what it is. You're looking out and you're seeing a certain trend that might trouble you. Yeah, fair enough. But it's just as immature to do the opposite to make a point as it is to just go along with it, because that's what everyone else is doing. You know, I mean, I have a laptop. One of my happiest years was when I didn't have a laptop. I wrote my fifth novel on a typewriter in London, Ontario, but I can't perceive that being my main method of novel writing in the future. I think it is just about that balance. It's just for me, that idea of balance is coming from the opposite way. It's the same thing with me with minimalism. I get a lot of anxiety when I witness people's accumulation of quote unquote stuff. I have a talent for downsizing and organizing. I'm helping my parents do that currently in this house. And there's always that kind of compulsive urge to have an overreaction and not have anything. And I've really had to learn to temper that. You know, and again, I think that's a lot of what being an introvert is sometimes you're kind of coming from the opposite direction of a lot of other people, not everyone, but perhaps the majority.
Yeah. Tempering our urge to overcorrect is kind of a lifelong endeavor for sure.
Oh my gosh.
That point was particularly salient in The Farm. And I remember thinking as I got to that story, it was an adjustment to go from a series of like, you know, 2 to 12 minute long kind of poems and short stories that were very wrapped up in one person's perspective in kind of an ethereal, like young woman's perspective around these experiences that she's having with sex work and kind of ancillary to sex work, to going into this kind of stark, like techno-pessimist, almost Richard Morgan-esque dystopia around the farm. And I thought that was a really interesting choice to start weaving these larger narratives into this book in particular. I'm curious as to why you chose to put the farm in this collection.
Oh, that's a great question, Blair, as to why I chose to put the Fun Farm in this collection. I have the literary agent who rejected this collection to thank for that. We got to a good place. You know, it was kind of like we were seeing each other for a bit and then, you know, and then they decided not to. I still consider it now a success because they did ask for full manuscript and, you know, my writing was to them strong and compelling, but their problem with the collection, with that draft of the collection, was that the stories were too similar. And at first I didn't understand that because I thought, well, it's a theme, you know, these are different sex workers in different scenarios. They're experiencing different magical things. And at first I disregarded that advice, which was foolish and prideful of me. And I'm very glad that eventually I took that advice to heart. And that amounted to the addition of that This Happened story, which we've already alluded to, and the Fun Farm. These were things that were offering slightly different perspectives of my writing and slightly different perspectives of characters. Of course, the main character in the Fun Farm, I actually fashioned all of the characters in that story after, you know, elements of psychological personality. Like the main character, you never hear her name, but her name was going to be Geo for ego. And then of course her little sibling is Dai for the id. And then Sona is persona and Cell is the self, right? And I'm like very proud of that little like pop psychology 101 Easter egg thing in there. Nice. But yeah, that was why is that, yeah, like obviously Geo is a sex worker, right? You know, that, and she's actually one of the more, I would say, reticent sex workers in the collection. You know, she is just doing it for work, you know, and the Fun Farm technically isn't in the big city either. So I think that was possibly the greatest rift from the rest of the collection. But at the same time, I think it's okay to stray away from a shared universe sometimes. And if some people interpret it as being in the big city, because of course, pre-revolution, the big city was very technologically advanced, you know, that's fine. It doesn't bug me if that's people's conclusions. That may eventually be mine also. But yeah, I'm so grateful to that agent for giving me that advice, because those are the stories people usually mention. That and You Only Die Once, which is a story that was rejected by, I think, a dozen magazines at least. So it's very vindicating to have people comment on that one too.
Oh yeah, that one was hands down my favorite. Absolutely. It was really, really beautiful. And certainly you're vindicated. Uh-huh.
Oh, and that one really was nice.
Interesting because it was so unexpected, right? I mean, I was really resonating with the experience that she was having of like servicing a bunch of super jaded, strange, but like friendly rich people, and anybody who worked in the service industry in any capacity, especially sex work, I think, and especially in a big city, will resonate with that description, and your descriptions are very visual. And then of course, you know, without ruining it, you know, the twist came and it was very, very unexpected. And then you realize like, oh, you're now taking kind of a Murakami turn. You're going for the magical realism thing here. And it worked really beautifully.
Well, I think that's a great comparison. Thank you. That's a very, very high compliment. And actually that was probably the story that I think really was the inception of the book. I was at a really low place in Toronto. You know, I was on, you know, support, which was like $300 a month or something pretty minuscule. Maybe it was a bit more than that. And I was in a really, really low space. And I was starting to look through my old unpublished fiction, among which was You Only Die Once, with a worse title. I'm not very good at titles, especially first draft. And I kept noticing this theme coming up in these old stories before I was old enough to even fully understand sex work. That muse was frequently present in, like, You Only Die Once I wrote when I was about, you know, between 16 or 18. And, you know, and there was almost always this idea of this, you know, sex worker protagonist. Back then I would have said, you know, prostitute protagonist. And it was just coming up all of the time. And I was looking at all of these different stories and thinking, wow, there's a theme here. And not only that, for me, it's now a lived theme. It's something I can stand behind in a just, reasonable way. And it's something that, you know, can empower and educate, but then it also has this magical background to it, you know. And I think that was always my idea with it too. Obviously, I hope there's more meaning to this book for people than just, oh, sex workers and magic, you know. If that's all people take from it, like, okay, that's fine. But I hope there's more, you know, themes of healing and hope in here too. But there has been that idea of not really feeling like I see this, you know. Winston Roundtree, who's an amazing writer, illustrator, and I'm actually starting to work on a little short film with him, which is super exciting. He's the creator of Subnormality and People Watching. His representation of a stripper in People Watching is probably the best I've seen. Candy, she's in the first and second season, and she's just a human being, you know, who happens to be a sex worker. And gosh, like, Winston is just so on point, and I'm so grateful to him. It was literally the first time I've watched a depiction of a sex worker in some content, not my own. And I didn't feel embarrassed or angry, which is usually the feeling I feel. Usually when there's a reflection of a sex worker back to me in media, I say, well, that's not me at all. Nor is it really anyone I encountered during my work. And that's not a nice feeling, which again, I think is the reason sensitivity readers should exist. You know, whether you think you're writing about something totally fantastical, if you're writing about people, it's going to be real to someone. And you best believe it's going to hurt if you don't do that right. And again, you'll never do it justice for everyone. My experience in sex work is, you know, incomparable, you know, as it is with any individual. It's all very personal and unique, but yeah, I'd love to see more stuff like what Winston did with Candy in People Watching and what I hope I achieved in Sluts and Whores. It's not flawless. It's honest and therefore I think clumsy oftentimes, but that's a lot of just processing these experiences too.
What would you say are the overriding themes of this book?
I always write with the misfit in mind, whether I really want to or not. Those feelings of isolation, rejection, not quite belonging, even if it's just not quite belonging to reality, you know, isolation need not be social. I think the worst isolation is existential. So that's always there. But again, I'm trying now that I've survived this long, and I don't use that word lightly, and I also use it with a lot of joy and gratitude in my heart, I try to more seriously look at things and again, bring that hope into it, bring that healing into it. You know, your story doesn't end with being a victim. And that was something I really wanted to shake off too. You know, like sometimes people, I think, mistakenly put one and one together and make three. If they simplify my biography, they're like, oh, mental illness, oh, sex work, oh yeah, it all tracks kind of thing. And I'm like, that's not really how my story goes though. You know, sex work, and of course it's always going to be more complicated than this, but as a whole, it was one of the most liberating and healing experiences in my life. It was one of the times in my life I did feel humanized and that I did feel a sense of belonging and purpose. You know, and that's not a narrative you'll always see. So that was something I really hope I achieved. It's not to, you know, erase the idea that there aren't victims. Obviously there are, but for my characters, even ones that sometimes go through a tough time, like Eden, I think is a good example there. Sometimes she hits some hard times, which suck, and she isn't treated great, and she's not a very assertive person, which is definitely me in lots of ways, you know, but in the last story that she's featured in, she makes it very clear how grateful she is for everything she's been through. I think she says something like, you know, the tough times were tough, but the good times made it all worth it. And I think that's just such a good attitude to have. And I think it's also a bit of a challenge. It's a bit of a challenging attitude to people who like to oversimplify.
Yeah. And I mean, there are times when she demonstrates personal progress or assertiveness or like taking control of her circumstances. I'm thinking a lot of the story 7-Eleven. And that story in particular had a vibe of kind of early mid 20s, right? When you first start to have those moments of like, I am an adult enough to fully understand, or at least pretty fully understand, the risks that I'm going to take by going my own way. And I'm ready.
Oh, I love that. I never thought of it that way, but you're right. It's a beautiful exposition of individuation. And you can tell that it's really that first step in Eden's life, that she's been really passive her whole life. Like, I always really envisioned her too as speaking with a lot of upward inflections. You know, she's uncertain, she's passive. She'll say yes when she means no. And that's why I love that story, because it's a turning point where she's like, no, like, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to do it in a way that works for me. And I think that's the most empowering aspect of any choice in life, is you can actually choose to do it right for you. And I sincerely believe that if a choice is truly right for you, for your higher path, for your best self, it's going to be good for others. Even if they don't like it, it's still going to be good for them. Like setting a boundary, you know, people don't always like it when you set boundaries, but that doesn't mean it's not good for you or for them. Some people need to hear no, and you're actually doing them a disservice if you just keep telling them yes.
Are there times in your own personal and professional journey where that's been particularly clear to you?
The only times I can specifically think of are really my own failings, ultimately, where I failed to abide my intuition. You know, where, you know, maybe there was a circumstance where when something was being set up or planned, it didn't quite feel right. And I didn't move into it with the right motivations. You know, maybe the motivation was just financial at that time, or coming from just a lower space of whatever. And I've definitely regretted those times for sure. Times when, and I think my problem is just, you know, being a perfectionist and being oversensitive and caring too much what people think, and recognizing that it's okay if you quote unquote let someone down or disappoint someone, or you just don't come out as shiny. You know, maybe people will like you, maybe people won't, and that's not really a big deal. The big deal is that you respect your cri de coeur and acknowledge intuition. Because I mean, I think intuition is just like the pragmatic side of Muse. You know, we're so lucky that Muse shows up at all, let alone that Muse shows up as intuition to go say hi to that person or to get away from that person as fast as you can. And I think it's really important to respect that. So those are the only times I can think of. And I know that's not very specific, but yeah, that's the thing, right? The no always comes back to you. I know that really, I mean, I'm highly agreeable too. I rate really high on the agreeableness score in Big Five traits. And I think agreeable people are always just kind of half hoping people will figure it out. And you can't expect that from people. You know, you need to say, by the way, you probably didn't notice, but that doesn't work for me. And then gauge your action from that. Because they might honestly say, oh, I'm so sorry. I had no idea that was stepping on your toe. I'll lift my foot. Some people might say, deal with it. And then, of course, that's when you definitely take your foot away and get off the bus.
Yeah, I feel like we could jump into a much, much longer and larger conversation about consent and work. Oh, yeah. And where how that continual process of boundary setting and boundary pushing basically is the formation of all relationships, but is also the formation or the foundation of one's own relationship with their creativity, right? I mean, you had mentioned earlier, you know, sometimes you think, gosh, a story that was meant to push the envelope should have or could have gone deeper. And you have to wonder, is that writer wrestling with giving themselves permission or having boundaries with their own creativity or pushing the barriers of their own experience, and whatever it is, their muse or whatever just said, no, not right now. We're not doing that right now.
Oh my God, totally. And I mean, I think that's my biggest problem is letting go, you know? And I think lots of people's problems is perhaps, well, no, it's different for everyone. Probably the more disagreeable you are, your issue is learning to let go and not cross so many boundaries. I think for more agreeable people, the problem is you need to learn to cross them. You need to learn to push yourself, you know, but that's just a general problem. I think people generally, and this is just like a survival thing, and it's totally reasonable. They opt for what is easy in the moment to conserve as much physical and mental energy and often emotional energy in the moment. But of course, I just love that old adage, you know, if you do what is easy, life will be hard. If you do what is hard, life will be easy. And it is no different with writing. I think there's no actual formula to success necessarily, but what I'm beginning to learn at really the beginning of my writing career is that you need to do the things you don't want to do. You need to do that which is tedious. You need to copy edit. You need to follow up. That's the biggest thing I've learned in promoting this book. You need to follow up. And most people don't, which I understand, but that's, I think, what often creates that division between, I would say, measurable successes and not. It's those little pain in the ass actions you need to habituate, whether you like it or not. And yeah, that's in the creative process, the promotional process, and obviously just in the interpersonal process. Because as solitary as writing is, it's still super interpersonal. You know, it's very interpersonal, but you have so many relationships. Like, you're literally putting a piece of your heart, and again, yeah, like that no longer belongs to you, but it's still connected to you. And you're just putting it out there for anyone to come and like run away with or copy or like just, you know, fart on. And that's really vulnerable. And you need to work that dance. You know, you really need to learn to two-step like a, sorry, can I swear on this podcast?
Yes.
You'd need a two-step like a motherfucker.
It's true. Why did you bleep in the audio book? Speaking of cursing.
Oh yeah, I did, didn't I? And now I can't recall. That was a delirious, I think, 2 days of almost nonstop recording. So do you mind reminding me what I bleeped out? I know I bleeped, but I don't always remember what I bleeped.
You actually just consistently say the word bleep instead of swears.
Instead of all swears?
Yeah, okay, yeah. I actually was like, I think that might be a stylistic choice, but it might also be a, are we doing the recording with a broader audience in mind? It's just hard to tell.
I think that was it. I think it was this idea of the written versus the spoken cuss. You know, obviously for cusses that are, you know, really deeply hurtful and offensive, I do my best to completely just censor those, even on the page, whether with asterisks or like in the this happened story, right? I just, you know, I imply a word used without actually using it. There is one ableist term actually that I didn't do that with, which is a failing on my part for this book that I will correct in the future with that story I'm thinking of. But yeah, that's all it really was, I guess, with that. I think it was a way to, yeah, avoid those words, like the words that some people just really don't like cunt is one of my favorite swears. I understand if like a feminine person told me like, I find that disparaging, I find that misogynist, please don't use it. I would say, oh, I won't, that's fine, you know. For me, I definitely think of it more as kind of taking that back, you know, and almost using it in the British way where it can almost be a positive thing. Like, oh, you're a good cunt, you know.
Canadians claim British privilege around the word cunt? I don't know. That's debate.
It'd be nice if we could. I mean, that the debate will continue. So yeah, I think it was just the easiest thing for me to do. And it could have also in part been audiobook recording delirium.
There is so much latent talent and experience in the sex work space. Do you have any advice for sex workers who are wanting to do more writing about their experiences, who are wanting to, or anybody who's, you know, in service, who's wanting to differently use their creative energy?
Yeah, I think that's such a beautiful idea. Actually, I'm talking with a community organizer here in Edmonton about a writer's workshop for teens. And that which you just kind of mentioned is my second idea, is writing workshops for sex workers, you know, through advocacy groups and everything. I definitely want to look into that eventually, because I think do it. And I would love it to just almost just open up the creative space in general. You know, it doesn't have to be writing. That's not everybody's voice, but just something that's going to express your story in this and how this part of you builds into that big, beautiful person that you are, right? Because I think that's always been the problem, is that one dimensionality that can occur. You know, like if you're a sex worker, you can't be anything else, you know, and that's just prejudice, which we're working to dismantle, which is great. And that's what I would really love to explore, is like, you know, what does being a sex worker mean to you? You know, how does it build your identity? What complexes, if any, do exist for you there, and take that into an art space? And yeah, I mean, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, if you're an introvert, I would say do it alone with your plant or your cat, you know, if you're lucky enough like me to have one. And if you're an extrovert, I would say definitely make a group space, you know, do that with your wonderful siblings in this, you know, in this complex, magical industry, because I really think that's what it is. I think we're really doing important soul work through this. Obviously, not every act of sex work would be included in that. We all work through things differently, but I think overall, it's something really sacred and immensely impactful. And we're doing a lot of important stuff, you know, and we deserve that respect. And I think that's one of the best ways to respect a story is by putting it down in paint or on paper, you know, with your words or with your movements. You know, I know this amazing burlesque dancer in Edmonton, you know, and they just do such amazing expression with their physicality about this kind of stuff. And I think that would be, this is long lingering advice, but that would be my main point of advice, which would be to recognize you are already creating. You are already creative. Sex work is an artistic force. And it'll take little effort for you to put that into another medium.
Where do you see yourself in like 5 years?
Oh, that's a great question. First, I have to do the math, which is not my strongest point. 9, 30, 1, 2. Oh, so 33, 34, because I have a birthday coming up soon.
Happy birthday.
And I'm definitely, oh, thank you. I have my Cancer voice on clearly when I, you know, that made my astrological sign very clear. I received that. Thank you. but yeah, so 33, 34, I definitely would love to see Observing Love's Decay published through a more traditional publishing house. I'm eyeing even just one literary agent in particular for that right now, which I'm really excited about, whether or not it works out with him or not. I would love to see that. I would love to see myself, should the universe permit, in a more stable place financially and locationally. I hope that my two beloved humans that I'm sharing relationships with will still be with me in some capacities. I hope my beloved cat will still be with me. And above all, I hope that I will be doing better, which is to say the best I can at 33 or 34.
I'm here from the other side of the 30s to tell you it's rad. I'm 35 this year and I'm like, this is rad. This is great.
Oh, that's awesome. You know, like you have such a groundedness in your philosophy and such a wisdom, you know, and I haven't seen you, the magic of podcasting, you know, so hearing that you're like, oh yeah, I'm 35. I'm like, oh my gosh, we're like in the same generation and you're so brilliant. So that is heartening for me. You know, I'm really excited for everything I will learn once I enter my 30s. And it's just so weird that I still have some of my 20s to go yet. That's almost a crippling thought, sometimes crippling in its excitement and its intimidation.
Yeah, I remember being a teenager and thinking like, I cannot fucking wait for this to be over. And then being in my 20s and like my early 20s were pretty good and exploratory. But towards the end of my 20s, like around the Saturn return, I was like, I cannot fucking wait for this to be over. And and once I hit my 30s, I again was like, oh, this is great. Like, I don't feel that at all. I don't feel like this And I'm wondering if, like, as I get up into, like, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, if I'm ready to be done with this phase will kick in that same way. But so far it's been exploratory and, like, revelatory in ways really similar to being in your early 20s, but a lot smarter.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like you have a do-over for that decade of evolution. Uh-huh. It's funny for me because, of course, I had no intentions of living past 18. You know, I tried very hard not to let that happen, to be totally blunt. and so it's all open for me in a way. Sometimes that's scary because it's like, I didn't plan any of this. I thought I was going to be dead. Like, I was not planning zombie. Exactly. You know, so, but at the same time, that's really beautiful because it's like there's this major rebirth and it's suddenly like I have all of this time and all of this space. And it's such a blessing, you know, to age, you know, like I've seen this anti-suicide campaign. I wish I could cite the, you know, the mental wellness organization, but I don't remember, but I saw it years ago and it was these personal stories and they were all called I'm Glad I Failed. And I just think that's the fucking bomb. I think that's so, so accurate. You know, it's like, and you do die, you know, there's a huge spiritual death there that happens with an attempt and then you're reborn. And yeah, I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be here with you. I'm grateful that, you know, to whoever has tuned in for this. And I'm just excited to see where we're all gonna go.
Where can people get the book?
Oh yes, of course. Plugs, love it. Exactly, it's imperative. Thurston Howell Publications, probably for your American listeners, that's your best bet because that's my publisher, which is an American publisher. They're great. And it's only $9.99 American on there. So you can just, I'm sure you can just look up Thurston Howell Publications, Sluts and Whores, C.E. Hoffman, and it'll pop up. For more general listeners, it is on Amazon, if Amazon is your thing. And for Canadians, it is at Indigo Chapters. And I'm very excited to say, if we have time, there's been a few indie bookstores now that have picked it up, mostly across Canada. And I'm sure I'll forget some of them, but I have to just give them a shout out and thank them. Thank you so much to Spartacus Books in Vancouver, to Audrey's Books in Edmonton, Mandala Books in London, Ontario, Venus Envy in Halifax. And one of the ones that I admit I'm probably most excited for, which is Book Soup in LA. They sent me the picture recently. I'm going to be posting that on social media soon. And I'm sure there are more I'm forgetting. I apologize to those ones because I'm so grateful to how responsive and supportive these indie bookstores have been. I really think of it as an indie book. I think it's an indie message. And if anyone is in those cities that I mentioned, please, please, please go out and support your local bookstores and request the book at your favorite bookstore. Please do. I'm right now chatting up some New York bookstores, hoping to get it in there. Oh, and the Edmonton, Alberta Library just picked it up, which makes me really happy. So any Edmontonians, just go and rent it at the library. I don't care. I just want you to read it.
Fabulous. All right. Well, thank you so much. And we will talk soon, I'm sure.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Blair. Take care. Happy full moon.
Thank you. You as well.
Today's episode was produced by me, Blair Hopkins. All in a Day's Sex Work is brought to you by Swap Behind Bars. Music by New Orleans' own Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Check them out at johnnysketch.com. Special thanks as always to Alex Andrews. To contribute to the good work she's doing, visit swapbehindbars.org. And remember, All in a Day's Sex Work is an ever-expanding narrative. If you are a sex worker, partner, patron, or other adult industry adjacent person, I want to hear from you. Email me at info@adswproject.org.